Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Carl Ulrich to the broadcast. Carl is the CIBC Professor of Entrepreneurship and E-commerce at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He also holds an appointment as Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Penn. Carl's research is focused on innovation, entrepreneurship, and product development, and he is the co-author of Product Design and Development, a textbook used by 250,000 students worldwide, as well as his most recent book, Innovation Tournaments. He is the winner of many teaching awards, including the Anvil Award, the Miller-Sherard Award, and the Excellence in Teaching Award at the Wharton School. At Penn, he co-founded the Weiss Tech House and the Integrated Product Design Program, two institutions fostering innovation in the university community. In addition to his academic work, Carl has led dozens of innovation efforts for medical devices, tools, computer peripherals, food products, web-based services, and sporting goods. As a result of this work, he holds more than 20 patents. Carl is also founder of TerraPass Incorporated and Zooter LLC, and he currently serves on the boards of several technology-based companies. Carl holds bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT. I recently caught up with Carl at his office in Philadelphia, and our conversation primarily focused on World-Class IT Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we spoke about innovation, as well as his latest book, Innovation Tournaments, and some related topics. Carl Ulrich, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. I thought we'd begin with your title. You are the CIBC Professor of Entrepreneurship and E-commerce at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. I know you also have a focus on innovation. I wonder if you could take a moment and describe your areas of interest and expertise.
Sure, Peter. For the 20 years I've been a faculty member, in some ways I feel like I've led a double life. On the one hand, I've been an innovator and an entrepreneur, and I've founded a half dozen or so new ventures in a lot of different areas. And I've also taught innovation and entrepreneurship. But on the other hand, my academic research has been in the area of process improvement and operations management. And so in recent years, I've tried to bring those two areas of expertise into alignment, thinking more about how to apply the principles of process management to this area I really have a passion for, which is innovation and entrepreneurship.
That's great. Maybe we can linger on that point for just a little bit. I know that innovation is a topic that, even for some companies still today, is more about inspiration rather than process. And I know that a lot of great companies are now trying to apply process to innovation. I wonder if you can take a moment and actually to speak to that a little bit. How have your areas of interest intersected in terms of applying more rigor, more process to the whole notion of innovation?
Certainly, the idea of process-oriented innovation might strike people as an oxymoron. I mean, we think of innovation as essentially consisting of a creative spark, which is something that most of us wouldn't consider to be amenable to process thinking. And I think the resolution of that conflict is really dependent on the unit of analysis with which we look at the process. If you look at the process abstractly enough, that is, if you take the 30,000-foot view, I think it can be extremely structured. And you can think about the opportunity as a generic flow unit, just the way you think of a widget in a factory. But when you look at the microstructure of innovation, when you look at that widget itself, that is the opportunity itself, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of creativity that tends to be involved. And so at the micro level, innovation, I think, is fundamentally, as you say, a creative act. And at the macro level, I think it is amenable to quite a bit of structure.
Very interesting. Maybe we can segue then into the book that you recently wrote, Innovation Tournaments. Can you take a few moments to explain the concept and how you've applied it with the companies with which you've worked?
Sure. The idea of an innovation tournament is it has a couple of essential features. At an overall level, an innovation tournament is an organizational process for finding exceptional opportunities. And it's comprised of at least two things. On the one hand, a tournament has to attract a large number of contestants or raw opportunities in the case of innovation tournaments. And then it has to have some way of differentiating the good from the bad, some kind of filtering process. And all tournaments have that essential structure to them. If you were to think about an athletic tournament, it would have those two pieces, a way to gather the teams or the athletes and a way to evaluate their capabilities or performance. And an innovation tournament has that essential structure where it requires a mechanism for gathering opportunities and it requires a mechanism for filtering or evaluating. And going back to the previous thread, the tournament itself can be quite structured in terms of the number of filters, the way the filters are applied, the way the raw opportunities are identified. And yet, those opportunities themselves can be very uncertain things, very creative things.
Can you take a moment and give us an example of some of the ideas that emerge and the process used in order to facilitate the emergence of those ideas?
Sure. Let me take a kind of an extreme example that I think would resonate with most of your listeners. If you were to look at the movie industry, and I'll take one example, which is Pixar Animation Studios. Pixar is perceived as one of the most creative organizations in the movie business and has had a series of remarkable hits. Most recently, I guess the animation feature Up. So while on the one hand those films are intensely creative endeavors, what most people don't know is that Pixar employs a very structured process for identifying the one film that they release every year. And specifically, it begins with a process where they consider about 500 one-sentence story summaries. And then they narrow that, they cut that 500 down to about 50, and then they'll develop a little one or two paragraph description of what the movie would be about, and then they'll filter again. And then they'll develop some storyboards for a few dozen opportunities, and they'll filter again. And they'll continue that process through about six or seven steps until they're finally animating, producing, directing, writing music for one feature every year. And so what we see coming out the end appears to be this intensely creative act. But while there is a tremendous amount of creativity at the micro level of creating each individual concept, the overall process is extremely structured.
That's interesting. So the spark, if you will, are these various potential ideas for the movies, but then a process is applied to this to help wean out which ones are the true winners, in this case, the real potential hits, versus those that don't appear to have the same potential.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Taking a step back, I wonder if you can talk a bit about the whole notion of the organizational structure related to innovation, the people facets of innovation. I know that a lot of organizations are beginning to develop dedicated innovation teams, while others continue to kind of make it a part-time exercise for a greater, more vast array of people in the company. Do you have a thought on a best approach, or is it something that is different for each organization?
I think the organizational structure and the administration and governance of innovation will be highly idiosyncratic to industry structure, to the history of a firm, to the leadership style of the people in it, to the size of the firm. But there are some things that I think we can say in general. And the first thing I would say is that it's important to distinguish between innovation applied to new products and services, that is, outward-facing innovation. And an innovation that's more inwardly focused, typically on business process improvement, cost reduction, efficiency, improvements in quality, those kinds of innovations. And I think if you look at that first high-level distinction, in most cases, the more inwardly focused innovation will be more intimately tied to daily work for a large number of people. That is, it will be part and parcel of your normal job to do internal process innovation. And I think the best organizations are those who enable, empower, and train their workforce to be innovators in their daily work. That's for the inwardly focused innovation. For the external innovation, that is innovation in products and services, there almost always in larger organizations needs to be some kind of coordinating entity. Often some kind of business development organization or new products organization, but some kind of organizational structure that is responsible for facilitating the pieces of the tournament, basically, for facilitating the gathering of opportunities, the filtering of and evaluation of opportunities, and importantly, for the portfolio issues. That is, how do you decide which of these 100 opportunities are most worthy of the organization's resources? Those functions do tend to be centralized to some extent, or I should say dedicated to some extent.
I see. And you bring up an interesting point of the sort of transition of these ideas into something that's a bit more actionable, applying a greater and deeper evaluation to tease out what really is possible with regard to the idea that some innovator has developed. I wonder, how does one turn major innovative business ideas into actionable steps? So, in other words, how do you go from a creative or theoretical idea to something that's more structured or implementable?
I would say in the 80s and 90s, both in academics and in practice, we did a great job of developing structured product development processes. And so virtually all organizations of any size have some kind of structured new product development or something is called an NPD process. And in most cases, those processes are basically what's known as a phase gate or a stage gate process. They have typically 3 to 5 steps in them. They have some checklists and some go, no-go decisions between phases. So most organizations are very comfortable with deploying or creating a product around a well-articulated mission. Where I think most organizations struggle is in the activities that precede that phase gate process. And that's really where the tournament logic, I think, makes the most sense, where you would benefit from investing your product development resources in fewer, better opportunities, and where the challenge is, how do you identify what those fewer, better opportunities are? And in that organizational function, that is the idea tournament that precedes the product development process, I do think that you benefit from having a coordinating body of some kind, a business development function or a manager of new business opportunities or some kind of dedicated centralized role for making sense of the many opportunities that an organization ought to consider. And so it's really, to go back to your original question, transitioning from the creative spark to the actionable new product or service. There's two pieces. There's first making sense of the many creative sparks you might invest in. And then once that decision has been made, there's turning the crank to make that opportunity into a product. And I think we mostly know how to do the latter. And I think organizations struggle more with the former. How do you make sense of all the different sparks you might invest in?
Yes, as you're talking, it occurs to me there are also cultural components to this because we always hear about innovative organizations being very comfortable with failure, for instance, and getting quickly to a prototype or a working version of an idea and helping to sort of test that before running it through a fuller implementation and a fuller product development life cycle, as you refer to with the traditional stage gates and so forth. How do you see organizations who may not have a comfort with the notion of failing and failing fast? And learning from failure as part of the whole innovation process. How do you see the development of this kind of an innovative culture within an organization?
There are a few levers on culture, and I like to think of five basic levers for an organization or actionable steps a manager can take to influence the culture of innovation. And so I'll just go through them. The first is incentives and recognition. And, put very simply, an organization's culture is what it measures and rewards, and or at least it's strongly reflected in what it measures and rewards. So you have to start with, are you actually recognizing innovation when it happens? And what you recognize tends to be what people value in the culture. And those incentives and recognition need not necessarily be In fact, they're rarely strictly the formal recognition and incentives, compensation and awards and so forth, but also the informal. So that's the first lever. The second is transparency about the rules and protocol by which organizations make decisions about innovation. And so I think it's important in building a culture to have thought through what is the process by which we decide how we allocate resources in innovation, and is that transparent to everyone? If it's not, then you tend to see people second guessing decisions that are made, people being confused when their particular innovation opportunity doesn't receive investment, and that can be a real damper on enthusiasm for innovation. The third lever is strikes, you know, will strike you as obvious or simple, but is the physical arrangement of the workplace. And typically, organizations that are more innovative are organizations that have more open physical arrangements where that allow more interaction and that allow more spontaneous interaction and problem solving among different people in the organization. And that's something that, you know, is pretty easy actually to change, but there's remarkable resistance to addressing.
Exactly. Simple idea, as you point out, but easier said than done in a lot of organizations, it seems.
Right. A fourth lever is one that people don't usually think of, but I think is critical, which is your recruiting process. And if you think about the very most important thing you can do to influence culture, it's getting the right people in the organization, and not only just getting the right people in the organization, but on their way in, signaling to them what your organization is about. And so, to the extent that your recruiting process is an innovative process, is a process that reflects your innovative culture, you'll tend to recruit people who are attracted to that culture. And you know, the more your recruiting process is structured and staid and process oriented and boring, the more likely it is you're going to attract people who have those attributes. And the last is a technique that most of your listeners will have heard of called slack time. But let me just reiterate, the idea of slack time is that the organization allows explicitly individuals to mess around with some fraction of their time working on really anything they want. And that's the idea has been popularized recently by Google, who allows their engineers, their technical staff, to invest up to 20% of their time in their own projects. But it really goes back to 3M, Hewlett-Packard, to several other well-established, long-standing, innovative companies, and is really a proven way to both signal the organization's commitment to innovation and to actually get some good ideas. So those would be some really actionable levers that I think any leader who has an inclination, who wants to make a more innovative culture, can actually take.
Those are great and very clearly and well articulated. Appreciate you walking through those. Returning back to metrics, which you mentioned at the outset there, I wonder how do you see the best organizations, the most innovative organizations, measuring their innovation, their capability to innovate once products are out there? Is it percentage of overall revenue that's derived from relatively new products? Is it some other kind of revenue or cost related metric? Are there others that you see coming forward to help organizations determine whether or not they're succeeding in their desire to become more innovative?
Well, honestly, although I've spent my whole career, really all my adult life, immersed in innovation, I'm a little bit old-fashioned about this, and I think what most organizations should care about is making money. And so I tend to be focused on how much money did a project generate. And I actually think it's kind of silly to focus on how many new products per year or what fraction of revenues are for new products. I mean, personally, I'll just take present value any day. I'm interested in did the organization create economic value? And so I believe that the more you can tie your innovation activities to the fundamental financial drivers of the industry, the better off you are, and the more likely you're actually going to be doing the right thing. So what do I mean by that? Well, let me first say what I don't mean. I don't believe that you can apply very accurately financial measures at the very earliest stages of innovation when you're just considering whether or not you ought to invest another month in looking at an opportunity. You can look at some things like, is it a big market? Is it a growing market? And so forth. But you don't typically apply financial measures early on. But fairly soon into the innovation process, before it ever becomes a real product development project, for example, I do think that one ought to apply some financial measures. And to do that, you have to use the relatively powerful tools of risk assessment, discounting the probability with the probability of success of a venture and so forth. But I think you can do that. And I think that opportunities ought to be evaluated based on what their economic return is likely to be, is expected to be. And then, perhaps most importantly, an organization needs to continually calibrate those forecasts based on its actual results over time.
Understood. No, I think that makes very good sense. I wanted to turn to one last topic, actually. There's a lot that's been written about including parties outside of the organization as part of the innovation process, most prominently external partners or vendors, as well as customers. And I wonder how you see this trend going. Is this something that has a staying power? Is it something that organizations should embrace? And naturally, there's a certain amount of risk. You mentioned risk as part of the evaluation process and the metrics to gauge the capacity and the results of innovation. How does one balance the risk of opening up innovation to external parties versus the potential rewards of engaging such parties?
Well, first, let me give a little taxonomy for thinking about the dimensions on which you can open innovation. The first dimension is the source of the opportunity. That is, do you look to the outside for the identification of the raw opportunities? And so you might imagine an internal, external allocation decision on that dimension. And then the other dimension is the extent to which your evaluation is done internally or in a more open, outwardly facing way. And that actually gives you four possible combinations. You can generate your opportunities internally or externally, and you can evaluate your opportunities internally or externally. And, so I guess let me just give some examples. If you were to look at an innovation tournament like American Idol, the entertainment competition, the opportunities are all external, and that is contestants show up. And the evaluation initially is done internally by the producers and so forth, but eventually migrates to an external evaluation where essentially the public at large is evaluating. And there's some economic reasons for doing it that way that make perfect sense in an entertainment competition. If you're Boeing and you're designing a new airliner, I think you're going to get a very different logic as to who you're going to want to evaluate the opportunities. And part of what drives that is who has the expertise, right? Where are the barriers to expertise, to really judgments, and who has access to the tools and requirements to actually do innovation in the industry. And in commercial airframes, very few people in their garages are doing significant innovation that's going to be of value to Boeing. And very few people in the public are in a position to decide whether a concept is valuable or not. And so typically that's going to be a more inwardly focused kind of innovation process. I would say in the aggregate, so that was kind of a little, academic perspective on the whole thing. But if I were just to give some general insights, we know from some of our research that in the aggregate, about half of successful innovation opportunities arise internally and about half come from external sources across all industries. But the generalization I would make is that I think the risks of opening up the innovation process are pretty small in general, that is, the costs are quite low. And so most organizations would benefit from biasing themselves a little bit more towards the open direction and less towards the insular closed direction. Very few organizations are too open, I would say, in general.
Good point. Good point. Especially those that are very risk averse would likely err on the side of not being open enough, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, the risks are really pretty minimal. I guess you could say that one risk would be to the extent that you invite the public to engage, or the open innovation communities to engage in innovation, you're signaling to your competition what you're interested in. But the reality is that if you have a smoothly functioning innovation process, at most you're giving people, 6 months or a year notice about what kinds of things you're interested in. A, that's not very much time, and B, they can guess pretty easily what you're interested in anyway. So I don't think you're revealing much. And then the other risk, I suppose, is that when you implement innovation, to the extent that you engage partners in that process, you are not appropriating all of the intellectual property associated with the commercialization of an opportunity. But in general, I think the advantages of agility, risk sharing, lower costs, are going to outweigh any potential loss of intellectual property that you might have by engaging partners in that process.
Great point, and I think a very convincing argument against the whole notion of the risk associated with opening up the innovation process. Well, Carl, I really appreciate you taking this time to participate in the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you sharing your views, your research, and your thoughts, generally speaking, on innovation and what you've seen work well and how you've seen the ideas that you've been working on applied within corporate America and beyond.
It's been my pleasure, Peter.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT: Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people, doing the right jobs at the right time, it will be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure, defined as software, hardware, networks. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will likely become stuck in a reactive mode, constantly fighting fires. And if systems and hardware work reliably, on the other hand, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It's important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and quality assurance, through to support and all other aspects of the IT department, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business. Now, if the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming crucial to corporations, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com. And please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our sound editor is Chris Davis, our web editor is Christian Dooley, and our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.